This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
President Masisi said immigration officials from both countries are finalizing the details before the new arrangement comes into effect.
That's Mokandisi Dube reporting from Gaborone, Botswana. Details coming up also. The Tanzanian government is holding journalist Eric Kabandera for questioning. And talks on power sharing between Sudan's military and the opposition has been postponed. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Tanzanian police confirmed today that they are holding journalist Eric Kabandera for questioning regarding his citizenship. Dar es Salaam Special Zone Commander Lazaro Mambosa said at a press conference in Dar es Salaam that Kabandera was arrested after failing to respond to a police notice to report at a police station regarding his citizenship. His arrest was widely reported as an abduction Monday after police initially said they have no information about the arrest. Hours later, police confirmed the journalist was in custody. Kabandera is an investigative journalist who writes for local international newspapers. His relatives say he was born in Kagera region, western Tanzania, in 1980, went to the University of Dar es Salaam, and has lived all his life in the country. A short time ago, VOA's Kate Pound Dawson spoke with Motuki Mumo, the sub-Saharan African representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists, about Kabandera's arrest and conditions in Tanzania for journalists.
Okay, so for us, this whole issue has been very irregular and very unclear from the beginning. And the reports that we received yesterday about how the people that came to arrest him didn't properly identify himself, and also the information that came to us from colleagues and other journalists who went around Dar es Salaam to look for him yesterday just pointed out to a very murky picture. So today afternoon, Tanzanian police gave a press statement where they said that they're holding him and they're questioning him on his citizenship status. And then again, this raises a lot of questions. And on the face of it, it seems to me like a way to justify what happened yesterday, a way to justify something that was done irregularly for several reasons. And the first reason is you've asked whether this is something that's coming out of the blue. It's actually not the first time we've seen him being accused, having his citizenship status questioned. In 2013, according to local media reports, his citizenship status was investigated, and he later wrote and believed that these questions were connected to his critical work as a journalist. And the government in 2013 did later dismiss the entire process and say that his citizenship and that of his friends were not in question. So that's the first reason. And then if you again look at the way there was just a lack of clear information yesterday about where he was, that some of the same people who were speaking today and saying that we do actually have him were approached yesterday by journalists and denied that they had him. All points to this question of citizenship being a way to justify something else. Now, what that something else is, again, is not completely clear. The people that we've spoken to say that they believe it could be connected to some of the journalism he's been doing recently. Some of his most recently published work has analyzed internal ruling party politics in Tanzania. And if you look at his history of journalism in general, he has been unflinching in criticizing power where it was needed.
Now, another journalist went missing about 2 years ago, Mr. Azori Gwanda. Is there any link between these two cases that anyone has been able to confirm?
No link has been confirmed, and we certainly haven't made such a link. But what we have seen is that what we do think is that both cases raise serious questions about the safety of journalists in Tanzania and press freedom in Tanzania. And both cases also call for credible accounting from the government, and they call for accountability on the part of whomever is involved in irregularly taking away journalists and compromising their safety and making it, sending fear through the Tanzanian media.
That was Muto Kimumo with the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Talks on power sharing between Sudan's Transitional Military Council and the opposition have been postponed after six people were killed in protests. Naba Mohadin reports for VOA from Khartoum. The deaths occurred in the city of Obeid.
Sudan's Transitional Military Council and opposition groups suspended talks on a draft constitution Monday after violence in the North Kordofan state killed six protesters, including school students. Talks were stopped at the request of the opposition, which condemned the violence against protesters who were demonstrating against Sudan's military council. Opposition leader Kamal Karar says it's an expected action that the opposition suspended the talks after the Obeid violence, where school students were killed. He says protesters want the talks to remain on hold indefinitely. Sudan's ruling military council said no military troops are responsible for killing protesters and blamed the death on shadow militias that were part of the former regime that are trying to create chaos and instability. Political analyst Khalid Al-Faki thinks any delay in reaching an agreement on creating a transitional government might affect the security situation in Sudan. He thinks suspending direct talks between the opposition and Sudan's Transitional Military Council will have a negative impact on the whole political and security situation in Sudan, and it will give the opposition a reason to delay forming a civilian government. Demonstration first erupted in December over the high price of fuel. Protesters continued to call for political change even after former President Omar al-Bashir was ousted by the military. Bashir ruled Sudan for 30 years before the military toppled him on April 11. The Transitional Military Council and opposition leaders agreed earlier this month to form a transitional government after 3 months of violent protests that killed hundreds of pro-democracy demonstrators. The streets of Khartoum and other cities were flooded with angry protesters and school students Monday and Tuesday, calling for justice and demanding the opposition stop the talks with the Transitional Military Council. Protesters like Fadia Khalaf think the TMC will not share power. Khalaf says that people are angry and protesting in the streets because the TMC is not committed to the signed political agreement. And it's so obvious that TMC doesn't want to agree because it's still violating citizens' rights and killing protesters. Sudan's military council and opposition agreed on forming a transitional government to run Sudan until elections. A final agreement had been scheduled to be reached this week before talks on the constitutional draft were suspended on Monday. Naba Mohadin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Algerian interim president Abdelkader Ben Salah has set up a six-member panel to oversee a national dialogue and hold a president election to end months of political crisis. Algerian Civil Forum for Change has proposed adding other leaders and experts to strengthen the panel. The group says it does not represent the movement that led to the resignation of longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika this year. Algerian Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Ahmed Gaid Salah, is managing the transition. He has encouraged protesters to join the dialogue, but they demand the departure of all officials regarded as part of the old guard. William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about whether the dialogue can succeed.
I don't think so, because the primary demand of the protesters right now is to replace Ben Salah and Bedoui, the prime minister. And so if these two officials are trying to set up a dialogue with a group that does not want a dialogue with them at all, it's destined to backfire. The main issue here is that the regime wants a constitutional and technocratic solution, because this panel would be technocratic. And the political crisis is outside of the Constitution and outside of a technocratic solution, in that the protesters want a complete replacement of who's at the head of the Algerian state before they have any dialogue. So, the actual announcement won't lead to any positive political outcome to resolve the crisis, because they don't have the right people in place.
Algerian army chief is still managing the transition in Algeria. Is he playing a waiting game with the protesters, or he has a genuine interest in a democratic transition?
I think a lot of his advisors, senior and mid-level rank military officials, have a desire for a democratic transition. There's recent polling data conducted online by Brookings, which showed a majority of both senior and mid-level Algerian members of the military and the junior members strongly in favor of democracy. And so they're there advocating for that. But the game, as you say, is primarily a waiting game, because ultimately, like in many other transitional moments, the regime gains if the protesters get tired of protesting. And so time is on the side of the regime.
So far, Algerian protesters are demanding, as you said, the departure of all officials regarded by them as part of the old regime. But did the protesters start to construct a roadmap and a united vision for the next Algeria?
Yes and no. Certainly, there's a lot of consensus about the overall objectives. There have been meetings of the opposition with varying degrees of success. And there's certainly enough there that a constructive dialogue could happen if the military put forth interlocutors who were considered less toxic by the protesters. The main problem here is that the Algerian regime doesn't fully seem to understand, or want to seem like it understands, that the Algerian population wants to hit a reset button. And wants that reset button to have a new constitutional basis and new characters involved. And as long as the what they consider remnants of the old regime are the front facade or face of the regime as their primary interlocutors, they're not going to want to deal. And so the Algerian regime, if they want a political transition that works for everybody's benefit, have to come up with new people that are more acceptable to the crowd. And there are plenty of them out there, as the Brookings report that I referenced indicates. There are, at least a half dozen characters who could preside over a more democratic transition, but the regime has not succeeded yet in recruiting any of them to lead up a dialogue that would be acceptable to the protesters.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University. He spoke with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Eighteen past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Globally, environmental and land activists continue to die in conflicts with government and commercial interests that want to develop and profit from land that is already occupied. Global Witness, an international nonprofit that investigates corruption, environmental crime, and human rights abuses, detailed the attacks in its annual report. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Alice Harrison, a senior investigator for Global Witness.
The environment is kind of increasingly becoming a battleground for human rights. And what we do is every year we document the number of people who are killed for defending their rights to their land and their environment.
And what did you find this past year?
We found that on average more than 3 people were killed a week. So that was 164 deaths in total. That death toll isn't probably much higher, because many of these killings aren't documented. It's rare for them to be investigated, which means that this can only be a significant underestimate of the true scale of the problem.
I know that places like the Philippines, Mexico, Brazil, India top the list in terms of the number of activists and land defenders killed. What's the trend been in Africa?
Something that we do report on fairly often is the fate of park rangers in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Last year, at least 8 defenders were killed in the DRC. And over the last 20 years, there have been more than 170 park rangers there who've been killed.
The report lays out very convincing objective evidence of all this murder. But what's it like emotionally to be tracking all this horror around the planet?
It's grim to be reading about these stories, documenting these killings day in, day out, but of course nothing compared to what it feels like to be living through those realities. And what I'm always struck with is the courage, the bravery with which these people carry on their fight, you know, against all odds. There are whole communities where people get killed on a regular basis. You know, there is a man from Mexico who we talk about in our report, a guy called Julian Carrillo, last year who was killed. He came from an indigenous community that was defending their land against mining companies. He was the sixth member of his family to have been killed in the last 2 years. And that's not to mention other members of the community who were killed too. And that only tells part of the story. They are being arrested, they are being jailed, some of them are being brutally beaten. And this is something that's only going to get worse over time. We have a growing population, which increases pressure on land because of increased demand for consumer goods. And climate change is going to make that a lot worse by depleting harvests. We're also kind of faced with a situation where globally governments are prioritizing business opportunities over civil rights, over protecting citizens. Laws are being amended, they're being created to crack down on protest, and land and environmental defenders are being locked into very expensive lawsuits, or, you know, they're being arrested and jailed. So this, of course, stops them from carrying out their work.
And their work basically involves ending or stopping land grabs. That's a term Global Witness uses a lot. What exactly do you mean by it?
Land grab is really about the theft of land. Most often a company will pitch up on a piece of land and start developing on it. Sugar plantations, palm oil, rubber plantations, etc. And often communities who have lived on that land, perhaps farmed that land for generations, may not have legally recognized rights to that land because that is not the tradition in that country, but it is theirs. And you see governments and companies taking advantage of those gaps in law, and they will forcibly evict people. And if they refuse to go, that's when the violence starts. That's when they send in the police, the soldiers, to violently force people out of their homes. That's where this whole problem begins, with a failing to consult people who live on land about what happens to it.
That was Alice Harrison of Global Witness speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. She is unsure that the global struggles for land rights will succeed. She hopes Global Witness will continue to promote official and corporate accountability, consumer awareness, and environmental justice. Botswana and Namibia have announced plans to scrap the use of passports for citizens of both countries and instead use identity documents. The neighboring country's two presidents met in Botswana over the weekend and said the new arrangement will be in effect soon. From Gaborone, Botswana, Mokandisi Dube reports.
Neighbors Botswana and Namibia plan to scrap the use of passports for travel between the two countries. Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi said citizens of the two countries will, in place of passports, use identity documents at border entry points.
It's so easy for us to agree that in the not-too-distant future, we are going to eliminate the need for passports for the citizens of Namibia coming to Botswana and citizens of Botswana going to Namibia. All you need to present is your valid ID.
President Masisi made the announcement Saturday at an agricultural show in Khanzi near the border with Namibia. He said the two countries enjoy historical ties with families found on both sides of the border. His Namibian counterpart, President Hage Geingob, who was the guest speaker at the agricultural show, said the two countries have much in common. He said ties were formed during the country's liberation struggle when a number of Namibians crossed into Botswana to seek refuge.
We are not just neighbors, but are bound by blood, making us brothers and sisters in the Southern African house in particular, and the larger African house in general.
An immigration expert in Gaborone, Sabine Mpo, said while the scraping of passports is an exciting development and a step in the right direction for Africa, there are questions.
When one uses a passport, the immigration officials indicate the number of days granted to the visitor to be in the country. How do you do this with an identity card? Again, passports are scanned at entry points for authenticity. What will happen with identity documents? I hope this will be answered.
President Masisi said immigration officials from both countries are finalizing the details before the new arrangement comes into effect. No date for implementing it has been announced. For VOA, this is Nkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Zimbabwe's central bank quietly eased a ban on using foreign currency in the country a month after saying all local transactions had to be in the Zimbabwe dollar. Adigando gives us more from Bulawayo.
The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe now allows oil firms, chrome miners, embassies, and international organizations to conduct local transactions in foreign currencies. In a circular released last week, the bank stipulated that those earning foreign currency could buy fuel in dollars and that chrome mining companies could buy chromium from small-scale producers in foreign currency. Economic analysts, however, say such policy inconsistency contributes to the country's economic stagnation. Dumis Banda is one of those concerned about the policy switch.
What it reflects is obviously there's no consultation with, you know, there's no consultation with stakeholders. If you allow one sector to use US dollars as they have suggested, and you buy others, yet in terms of practicality for the other sectors, it is such that they can survive and go through the VAT if they operate in foreign currency. Because
Smanda says the ban forces many companies to scramble for foreign currency on the parallel market, fueling inflation. He also thinks the government is struggling to rebuild the economy because of a legacy of populist policies and a lack of research before policy changes are made. Kudamanzanga, with the Foreign Currency Trading School, says the latest policy shift is necessary.
And therefore, it didn't make sense for a director of a formal enterprise, which pays taxes formally, to then have to go to the street to, as it were, or not be able to access the foreign currency. And we're happy to see this coming back.
Manzanga is one of those who had been affected by the ban on foreign currency transactions. Economic analyst Reginald Shoko sees the move to partially reintroduce the use of foreign currency as a logical step in dealing with what he calls distortions in the market.
Hence, the Reserve Bank might then try to, what we call, incentivize exporters and foreign currency generators by improving their efficiencies, by allowing them to use their proceeds for various requirements that they have. You look at the reintroduction of the use of US dollar by other sectors, specifically to look in the issues of efficiency, the chrome miners, and they need too much electricity involved. So you rather allow them to use US dollars to import their own electricity.
Shoko thinks it may be wise for the government to allow all big mining entities to use foreign currency to meet their own energy requirements, which would ease the burden on the faltering national power grid.
Allow them to use their resources, and that is in foreign currency, to import from the SADC grid their own electricity for a limited period, whilst they're also building capacity to generate their own power.
Zimbabwe halted the use of its dollar to combat crushing inflation. Since then, Zimbabweans used the rand or US dollar for daily business, as the government introduced bond notes as a local currency. It currently issues what are called RTGS dollars. As inflation has soared over the past year, civil servants, particularly teachers and health professionals, increasingly demanded payment in US dollars. There has been a severe shortage of foreign currency in the country, crippling business. Economists say policy uncertainty will further hamper business. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how long Can a head of state maintain effective leadership? Some African leaders are forced out of office, while others respect the political process. The politics of transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.